Hello and welcome to Microbrew, Brewer's Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. My name is J.R. Radcliffe. On the other line, the one and only Kurt Hoag, beat reporter, covering the Milwaukee Brewers for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It was a pretty busy week, 3-3. They go to Chicago, lose 2 of 3 to the Cubs. Craig Counsell season, we got to talk about that, of course. Prior to that, they had taken 2 of 3 at home from the Tampa Bay Rays. So much happened in that series. I'm sure we all thought the Cubs series would be the highlight for the week. No, we have so much to discuss from that Rays series. But we are going to start with the most recent stuff. Kurt, I'm not going to lie to you. I didn't get a chance to watch any of Sunday's game. Did see the score, though.
What did you miss?
Absolutely nothing. Just going to ask what I was going to miss. Pretty sure we could just pretend Sunday never happened. But they do lose 2 of 3 overall. Craig Counsell and the Brewers reunite. I would say it was, I don't know if anybody thought there was going to be anything too exciting to stem from the series in Wrigley. You know, not really. I don't know. Players are not seemingly that fired up about it when you spoke to them before leading into the series. It wasn't really top of mind for everybody. And I think we kind of saw that played out. But is there anything? You were there for all 3 days at Wrigley Field. Any Craig Counsell stuff that you pulled out from this 3-game set against the Cubs?
A couple things short on the Craig Counsell stuff. Number one, there were some boos when he was announced when he came out for Friday's lineup exchange. Not when he was announced. I was not in my seat when that happened. But when he came out, there were some boos. And the other thing too is it was less so on Sunday's game for whatever reason. But I noticed Friday and Saturday, a lot of Brewers fans in Chicago, young Brewers fan crowd. Still pro Cubs, obviously significantly, but like. It was loud in there when the Brewers were making their rallies, like really loud.
I heard that over the radio, and truthfully, I was out and about with friends on Saturday, out at a beer garden, actually, 'tis the season, and the game was on. I couldn't really tell what was going on, but people kept cheering, and I'm like, oh, Cubs finally got out of the inning. It's like, no, South Freelich just doubled. It was very disorienting. So I don't know. I think it sounds like the Brewers fans are energized this year to get down to Chicago.
Yeah, there's some animosity there for sure. Those are the two things mostly that I noticed related to Craig Counsell. It just wasn't a huge part of this series, weirdly. It'll be a bigger part when it comes back to Milwaukee. The animosity, JR, does not seem to be going anywhere. Somehow, though, after a week where the Brewers played Craig Counsell, one of the top villains in Wisconsin sports in the last 20 years, that's like a minor storyline, relatively speaking, in the week.
Yeah,
it was a week.
I feel like we're going to wind up talking mostly about the Tampa Bay series, which at this point is a little bit in the rearview mirror. So I just want to make sure we hit anything that happened in the Cubs series that we really want to talk about. I thought, you know, like it's a 2-game sample at this point. You see some of these sort of struggles come to roost with the pitching that we keep talking about. I feel like the Brewers are still teetering without actually falling over. It seemed, you know, Tobias Myers, I think on Saturday had another one of those starts where it wasn't good. He went 3 innings and he gave up 4 runs, and that wasn't good. But at the same time, the Brewers held it together. They allowed a couple runs with the bullpen, did just enough. That feels like the MO of this team. And then sometimes those rallies click into place like it almost did Saturday. And sometimes the offense just doesn't have anything like was the case Sunday. There's a few players I want to talk about eventually here who, I don't know what the future holds for them. Abner Uribe, Oliver Dunn a little bit, Joey Weimer, like, you know, the injuries getting sent down. There's some stuff there, but I don't know. I don't know what to take away from the Cubs series other than the one big thing might be, I think the Cubs are better than the Brewers because they're nursing a ton of injuries too. And they still have a lot of stuff going their way, including starting pitching. That's at least in this series, extremely, extremely good. And these are not their frontline guys. You know, they're missing Justin Steele. Kyle Hendricks was ineffective before he got hurt. Like, there are more guys to come. Cody Bellinger on offense. And they're still in pretty good shape, I would say. If their bullpen held it together, the Cubs would have swept this series. So I feel like it's a concerning little signpost that the Cubs, I think, are the team to beat in this division, if I'd say that right now on May 5th. I don't know if it's too early to make any proclamations of the sort, but what would you say to that?
Well, the division is now looking a bit more as we expected. I don't think we thought the Brewers and Cubs would get off to this kind of start, JR, but everyone else kind of stinks. The Cardinals, it's yes. Over, brother.
They're down so bad. Done. They're down it's so done. Bad.
I, I there's still that thought in the back of my head as I pronounce the Cardinals over that, like, is like, don't do that.
Yeah. We but did that all last did, year, and they're like, you know, 20 below
early last year. So I think we're feeling it a little bit. Yeah. Little heat check.
Yeah, it's not happening. By the way,
speaking of Craig Counsell, I don't think I ever asked a heat check question to Craig Counsell. Like, you get a couple of questions that you're like, I don't know if this is going to get answered. And then it gets answered, and then you just keep going. Absolutely did that with Pat Murphy on Sunday. We just kept rolling, and then at the end, I was like, is Robert Gasser going to pitch? And you know what? We knew we weren't going to get an answer, but we kind of got an answer. We can talk about that later, probably Friday. He'll probably pitch Friday. Anyway.
Yeah, spoiler alert, he's going to pitch.
The Cardinals are probably done. The Pirates, they are not it. That offense stinks. The Reds, probably better than they're playing right now, but they're probably not a great team either. And, yeah, you know, maybe the Brewers are playing above their talent level right now. Maybe the Cubs are playing right around theirs, but, like, you also can't forget the Brewers are super injured too. Like,
of course,
yeah, right. the Cubs are missing Bellinger and Steele, and, you know, Seiya Suzuki's coming back. Oh no, he missed a few weeks. Tell it to the Brewers, who everyone is missing centuries.
Yeah.
Christian Yelich was hurt. Devin Williams is hurt. Brandon Woodruff's hurt. DL Hall's hurt. Jacob Junis is hurt. And then he got hit by a fly ball during batting practice on the warning. Like, their entire team is hurt too. So I think if, you know, you can't look too much at, like, oh, well, the Cubs are going to get better because they'll get guys back. That's going to happen for the Brewers too. How many games have there been where, like, they could really use Christian Yelich here? Saturday, they really could use Christian Yelich hitting third. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So
it sounds like you got a good update on Yelich, by the way, on Sunday.
It sounds like it's going better. I mean, he was swinging every day. He was out there on the field doing things. The big ice pack was noticeably gone from his back for pretty much the entire weekend. So it's still always a day-to-day thing with the back. I know people, like, want regular updates, and if there's a couple days without an update, is there an update? Like, I understand that. That's totally normal. You want to know if the best player on the team is coming back. I get it. I was trying to find out if Giannis was coming back for the playoffs. But the reality with the Yelich back thing is there's not always an update. Like, you can read a little bit into the activity that he's doing. He's doing 3 straight days of swinging. That's really good, because whenever there's, like, a little bit of discomfort, they back off. So we've got to be getting closer, but it's still a ways to go before you face live pitching. So that's where we're at with Yelich.
I am going to finally, one of these days, get this right, where I introduce the interviews that I have at the end of this podcast episode, like, out at the front, at the outset. I don't know why I'm just thinking of it now, but I do have a conversation with Tobias Myers, who we'll talk about, starting pitcher for the Brewers. Made his, what are we up to, 3 starts now? 3 starts after his start in Chicago. Also, Ben Rortvedt, who's a catcher for the Tampa Bay Rays. And let me tell you, we're about to talk about catching for the Tampa Bay Rays and what that means. He is from Verona, Wisconsin. You know, he's playing for
Shout out to the Wildcats.
That's right. I believe first Verona High School alumnus to make the big leagues. He was there, caught, started all 3 games for the Rays, having a nice little breakout. And he's been in the big leagues a little bit, had a ton of injuries. Anyway, that's coming up at the end. But there's a reason to tie in Robert Gasser that you mentioned. There's a reason why Robert Gasser is going to be needed this week. And that's because Freddie Peralta is essentially going to get pushed back one day because of the suspension that he received on Wednesday in his battle with the Tampa Bay Rays. It was a wild, I said Wednesday, Tuesday, but it was a wild set of circumstances. He was ejected for plunking a batter, allegedly, according to Chris Cuccioni, the home plate umpire, who felt that it was on purpose when he hit Jose Siri. Jose Siri had hit a pretty big home run earlier in the game.
JR. A pretty good home run.
Right. A pretty good home run. He got it pretty good. As Chris Cuccioni told you, the pool reporter, after the game, as if that were some reason to think that there would be retaliation because it was a well-struck bomb. Very odd. Siri, anyway, so he celebrates. He's allowed to do that a little bit. Didn't get much of a reaction from Freddie. And then later in the game, Freddie, on a 3-0 pitch, hits him, you know, plunks him in the leg. I would say this, it doesn't feel like that's what Freddie Peralta normally does. If there were a spot to hit a batter, that's probably the spot to do it there. 3-0, I think there was one out, nobody on base. Chris Cuccioni wasn't having it, immediately ejected him. And what transpired, I feel like, stems from that. First of all, he's got the suspension. He had appealed it. He makes a start today. He said he's going to drop the suspension. He'll be out 5 games, which means he'll still be available to come back Saturday. Pretty light suspension if you believe that he hit a batter. That doesn't really feel like it's much. He gets pushed back an extra day. Brewers are like, fine, we'll give him the extra day of rest. But they'll need a starter before that, and that's where Robert Gasser comes in. So anyway, that's one of the ripple effects. But later in that game, as many people know by now, there's a brawl. Abner Uribe and Jose Siri get into it after a play at first base. Abner Uribe, volatile young man, winds up kind of slapping at Siri. Siri fights back. Uribe gets a 6-game suspension, which he is also appealing. Pat Murphy was suspended for 2 games that he has served. Ricky Weeks, shout out to Ricky Weeks. Not officially 2-0 because of baseball rules, but 2-0 in our hearts. And then, and then you obviously had Peralta getting suspended as well. I still think this, it was too quick a hook. If it's me from the umpire throwing out Freddy Peralta there, I think that sets the table for the temperature being elevated later in the game with Abner Uribe. Now, I'm not blaming Abner, Abner Uribe should not have done what he did. That was craziness. But the umpire, I think the idea there is to not let it get out of control by quickly saying you're ejected. We believe you threw at the guy instead of doing the whole warnings thing, the whole system thing. I think what had happened was the reverse, though. It ended up elevating the temperature and creating an environment where you had two teams that were very much at odds with each other. That's speculative on my part. But ultimately, what you had was an absolute disaster class of a game on Tuesday that had some long-term ripple effects. I think I hit all the high points, but you got to talk to Chris Cuccioni afterwards, which was kind of wild as well. So give me your recollections here.
Well, okay, first off, I'm going to say, I'll get to the Cuccioni thing, but you said it was speculative on your part, but I don't think that you should say that to discredit your opinion, because it was speculative on the umpire's part.
Of course, yes.
This was maybe the most speculative ejection of a player throwing at another player that I've ever seen. Like, usually when a guy gets tossed, it's obvious why he did it. Anyway, number two, just a clarification. I didn't speak to Cuccioni on Tuesday, but a very understandable mistake for you or someone else to make, because we had 3 straight days of pool reports, baby.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, man. I had no idea how to get to the umpire room before Sunday. But let me tell you, I have trotted that path. I have sat on the couch outside that room. I am familiar with the security guard who watches over that door.
Mm-hmm.
I know what the spread is. I know what it smells like in the umpire's room.
I'm not interested in that information.
Okay. So I wasn't there Tuesday. I did Sunday and Monday's pool report.
That's right. That's right.
We had gone years, I think, without a pool report in a game at home. We had 3 in 3 days.
Of course, but Sunday was the Aaron Judge play, which we talked about. Yes. Monday, this catcher's interference play that we will talk about.
I'm willing to make myself as much of a part of the story as we're willing to. After all, that's why my friend Grant Bill says there's a me in media for a reason.
Yes. It was Adam McAlvey, anyway, but wild pool report.
It was McAlvey who did the pool report. And I don't think that this pool report helped Chris Cuccioni very much. I think that's putting it lightly. It was, I thought his answers were sort of sloppy and definitely did not help his case. I mean, he effectively said, no, we did not see anything happen between Peralta and Siri as he ran the bases. Oh, and then by the way, the 1-0 fastball that was, a little inside and, could have hit him around the thigh if it had been 6 more inches inside. That kind of raised some eyebrows. And then 2 pitches later, when he hits him in the butt, we threw him out of the game. So you didn't say anything to anyone when you thought the 1-0 pitch that didn't really come that close to clipping him, but was just inside. You thought that had intent and you didn't say anything, and that had an impact on 2 pitches later when he hit him. It just looked like from the get-go, when Cuccioni called everyone together, he wasn't interested in soliciting the opinions of the other umpires. He said, I got to get this guy out of here. He was trying to control the game for what he thought was an intentional hit by pitch, which I guess the reality here is we will never know. A lot of the time we can infer with certainty. In this case, I can't infer with certainty either way. Like you said, if you're going to hit a guy, that's a spot to hit a guy, and he hit him in the butt, which you don't want people throwing at other players, but at least it wasn't the head. You know what I mean? So all that said, like, just issue warnings, man. Issue warnings. And you know what does more to settle tempers than ejecting a guy speculatively is issuing warnings, because no one's going to throw at someone else the rest of the game. Like, Peralta's not going to throw at someone. He's trying to go 7-8 innings. This is a guy that doesn't go deep into games, and that was his chance to do it. He's not going to throw and hit a guy on purpose again. So I thought it was at best a speculative ejection, and at worst, an incredible overreach and borderline like abuse of power by an umpire. And then, of course, he's going to get suspended when you eject a guy from a game for throwing at someone, because the league's not going to sit there and go, yes, our umpire was wrong. Oh, well, okay, they did do that on Sunday against the Yankees, but the umps admitted they were wrong. The league's not going to go against their own umpire's call.
Yeah, I think you're the one who posted this, and I don't know if this was hard and fast certainty on the research, but 16 times you'd had in big leagues this year, a player had homered and been hit by a pitch later in the game. And in none of those 16 occasions were somebody ejected. Freddy Peralta's a very laid-back guy. The umpires don't know that. They don't need to know that. But he's not demonstrative on the mound. He's not chirping.
As Pat Murphy said to Chris Guccione per the John Boy video.
Great breakdown.
You don't know my effing pitcher.
Yeah, that's just not who he is, right? Like, that's not normal for him.
That'd be a good t-shirt.
You don't know my effing pitcher. We do need that on a t-shirt. It just didn't feel right. Now, again, 3-0 on a guy who Cadillac'd a home run earlier in the game. I got to admit, like, perfect moment for someone to throw at a guy. We have not seen that much from the Brewers this year, or I should say in recent years under Craig Counsell. It's a new manager, new system. Maybe there's something there. You can't dismiss that out of hand. I think, though, like you said, the warning makes so much more sense there. It's like, okay, before this gets out of hand, let's just settle down. And who knows if Abner Uribe still does what he does later in that game. But it feels like we were at a place we didn't need to be. And that was because the umpire, like you said, made an overreach and drew some conclusions that I didn't feel like they were absolutely there. So that's what we had happen. Abner Uribe is kind of an interesting situation. I do want to talk a little more about him. But first we'll go back one night, the previous pool report.
Oh, whoa, okay. We're going to skip back one night and then go back to Abner.
Well, let's do Abner now. You're right.
Okay, sure. We can just hit it now.
Abner Uribe has struggled in addition to this. And now he's going back to AAA. He's got a suspension to serve there before he can come back. And I got to tell you, knowing that he has a 5-game suspension waiting for him, pending appeal, whatever, 6 games, I don't think he's going to be back before September, Kurt, because I think, are they going to wait until the rosters expand when they can afford to have a guy just benched in the bullpen for 6 days? I mean, that seems crazy, but he hasn't been sharp. I mean, tell me what you're thinking about Abner Uribe right now.
Yeah, it's going to be tricky to like call a guy up knowing he's got to sit for the next 6 games. But I also think like the Brewers' view of Abner Uribe's importance this year and beyond goes beyond like a little bit of difficulty with, you know, a taxed bullpen. Like maybe there's a stretch of the year where you can go 4 starters and just carry an extra. Like there are situations. I would expect to see him before September, although if that ended up happening, I could understand it too. And if the team wants to send a message, the thing I don't love about this suspension and, you know, the fight and everything is like the referendum on Abner Uribe. He's a bit of a volatile person. He's got a temper for sure. Like what happened in that game absolutely cannot happen at the major league level. Like getting suspended 6 games for fighting over literally nothing.
Yeah.
That can't happen. But I'm not going to turn it into like a big diatribe on, you know, a contentious contentious personality that, you know, like we knew this about Abner Uribe. He's got a little anger, temper in him. You just hope it doesn't come out in a game, and it can't, and it's inexcusable. But yeah, that's probably where I'll draw the line on that. And the other thing too is like, I think maybe it was some people like within the Brewers or like some fans that wanted like the Guccione doing what he did in the sixth inning, equating that or saying it led to Uribe's actions in the eighth. I don't love that either, because that just can't happen. Yeah. Like, maybe it doesn't happen if Guccione says nothing. Maybe it doesn't happen if he just offers warnings. Maybe. But I this kind of thing can't happen.
Yeah.
If you're a big league pitcher, like, I understand tempers flare and, you know, you jaw, but you can't get into a fight and start throwing punches over that. Yeah. Especially it's like, just, if a guy throws at my head, maybe I'm swinging. I might be swinging in that instance. But not when you guys are just jawing about looking at each other. So I think that's my take on the Abner Uribe situation. Also, he needed to go down to AAA, if we're being honest. Like,
he struggled.
The pitching was bad.
Yeah, it's not happening right now with him. So he's got to sharpen some things up. But, you know, even if you believe lock, stock, and barrel that Freddy Peralta threw at him, well, okay, he hit him. So solved, right? Like, that's the end of that. There's no reason to, like, renew that tension with Jose Siri. And I mean, whatever. Over like, what, pimping a home run? Is that really? The nice thing about the Brewers the last few years is they haven't gotten bogged down by foolishness like that. So you don't even like that from any player on your team to be bogged down in foolishness. And Uribe, like, you know, he's a little bit like Patrick Beverly. You love him when he's going well, and he's got that weird fire, sometimes weird, but mostly just passionate fire. Beverly's a little different. He's a veteran who should probably know better, whereas Uribe is a very young player, and there's a lot, you know, he's still learning how to be a big leaguer. But, you know, when things go wrong, you start to wonder if this is just a little bit too much extra to be dealing with. So Uribe for a bullpen that just, you know, like, is asked to do so much, they can't afford to have a guy who's not pitching well at this point. And so they do make that move, send him down to the minor leagues. We'll see if he can when he can work his way back. Let's go back to the night before. Tampa Bay Rays win the game 1-0 against the Brewers. The Brewers seem to have tied the game in the ninth. Sal Frelick scores on a pass ball. We learned that however, the ball was ruled dead. Jake Bowers had swung and missed at strike three. Backswing hits the catcher. Jake Bowers doesn't move out of the box or doesn't, you know, change his swing path in any way. Just a normal regular swing, happens to hit the catcher who was trying to stop the ball in the dirt. Rene Pinto skirts through his legs, but the ruling is kind of cut and dried. If your backswing hits the catcher, that is interference, backswing interference, play is dead. Batter's out. Batter gets a strike, I believe, officially. I'm not even 100% clear on that, but I mean, it was strike three anyway, so that's kind of beside the point. And every runner has to retreat to their base. The Brewers, of course, do not score. They lose the game 1-0. I think this is a long enough ago now where I think everybody kind of settled at the same point, which is they called it correctly. They adjudicated the rule correctly. The rule makes absolutely no sense. There has to be some sort of judgment component whether or not that backswing has a tangible impact on the outcome. That ball was through the legs of Rene Pinto before the backswing hit the back of that helmet. There is absolutely, you cannot convince me that backswing had anything to do with the outcome on the field. It is just a hard and fast rule. Once that bat hits the catcher, boom, dead ball, everything. It's sort of dead ball. They could actually still get the out on the bases, but for the most part, the offense can't do anything at that point. I find that ridiculous, but MLB rulebook is littered with this stuff, and I don't know if this would get changed down the line or whatever. This is just stuff that kind of pops up and sneaks up on you, and I think it was called correctly.
I don't think it's going to get changed because it hasn't been changed by now, and it makes no damn sense.
Yeah, right. Well, it takes a moment like this to bring it to it light,
I think. It was the correct call, and like the Brewers were upset after the game and during the game because it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, like watching it live. And then, but you have no idea what the rule actually is in the moment other than this doesn't make sense. And then there were some rules about interference on dropped third strikes, which did seem to suggest the Brewers had an argument to make. But in this case, the backswing is the actual call here. It's the actual rule. There's not a whole lot of wiggle room, which is the issue with the rule. Like, there's no place for judgment of umpires. Now, I have a bit of a feeling that the judgment in this case might not have been good anyway. This was a crew that they like the calls they make. Let's just put it that way. So I don't know if they would have overturned it, but like come on, like, come on. If you've watched baseball, you have a feel for the game. You know, Sal Frelick scoring on that play anyway, Jake Bauer's backswing, had minimal, if any, impact on the play that transpired or would have transpired after it. Pinto even slid a bit into Bauer, like into Bauer's bat path.
Yeah, he's the guy who moves into the situation.
Might have clipped him anyway, but Pinto did move a bit into the bat path. So there's no wiggle room in the rule for like a normal bat path, which I think Bauer pretty much had. It was in kind of a normal swing.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's just not a great rule, but it was, yeah, it was called correctly. The thing I wonder is if, you know, the Brewers popping off about the rule after the game carried over into the next night. Maybe. I don't know. That's all speculative, but it felt like you can't say it definitely didn't carry over.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, it's funny how all these things, you know, coupled with the Aaron Judge play on Sunday, they just all went against the Brewers. And I think the natural question is, what's to stop a catcher from getting in the way of the bat path and triggering this in a situation where it would be advantageous to do so? My response to that is like, dude, these guys don't have the ability to process fast enough to get their faces in the way of a bat because the ball is going to maybe slide past them.
That's yeah, you would have to know within about 0.15 seconds that this guy's going to swing at it. I'm not going to get it. And I can move far enough to have him hit me.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Physically move far enough to make that
happen. But it happened here. The guy did move forward into the bat path. Like, whether you did try to do it or not, you know, like, let's put some common sense in this rule.
Yeah. I do feel like the catcher has a pretty good amount of liberty there. You know, like the catcher, you know, the batter has to be mindful not to get in the catcher's way when he's throwing the ball. Like, I don't know. Sometimes I feel like it's weird that the guy with the most equipment and most consideration also has the most considerations, but that's baseball. That's how it goes. So that ended up costing the Brewers again. That was the first loss of the week on Monday. A couple players I want to hit on before we get to three up, three down. We haven't talked at all about Tyler Black coming up here. We can maybe do that in three up, three down, but he had a really nice debut. Our guy, Tyler Black, finally in the big leagues. It was a little bit of up. It was the down part of the up and down when he went to Chicago and came up in some big spots and struck out a few times. So I'm sure, you know, I'm sure there'll be a learning curve there as well, but Tyler Black is here. But before, and again, we could talk about him in three up, three down if you want. Joey Weimer, Tobias Myers, Oliver Dunn. Those are the three guys I'm interested in. Joey Weimer got hurt. He's going to be out for a couple weeks. I guess there isn't much to know about that other than he's going to be out for a couple weeks. And I wonder where his place is going to be when he's healthy. And then Myers, I think, is going to get another start, but I'm not positive. It's been just okay, I think, with him. And as you know, big Tobias Myers fan, hoping for the best there. But I don't know how much longer that leash is going to be. And then Oliver Dunn has really struggled. He started out hot, and I'm surprised he's still here. I thought he would be the guy to go down when Black came up, and it was Owen Miller instead. They do love having that left-handed swinger at third base, so I guess that's part of the equation there, but he seems still a little bit overmatched. So give me just some rough thoughts on those guys before we go into the next stage here.
I think as a whole, you can probably put Weimer and Dunn into one picture. Well, Weimer's going to be on the injured list here, but the Brewers bench, I can't think of many times where it's been weaker. They're like in the last few years, the lineups would all like change every day with just different guys, and they're still changing every day. But like, just the secondary guys, it's kind of slim pickings right now. Oliver Dunn's really struggled. Andrew Monasterio's got a bench spot right now, and I was thinking today, like, what's the scenario in which he gets into this game?
Mm-hmm.
Gary Sanchez is hurt, but also not hurt, but also hurt enough that Eric Haas is still on a taxi squad and Gary's not getting into games. I don't know. And then, you know, Weimer's really struggled as well. So Christian Yelich got to come back. And that's the answer here. And then some of the problems start to answer themselves. I think Joey Ortiz as the everyday third baseman is a move that needs to happen. Talked about that Sunday pregame with Murphy where he said Ortiz is considered his starter, but he had started Oliver Dunn the last three games to kind of like see what the kid had. Sounds like they're considering sending him down.
Yeah.
The issue, of course, is like you send him down.
Who takes that spot? Unless you're
activating someone off the injured list who's good. What's the, like, Tyler Black's here already. What's the upside move here? Is it more Owen Miller? Okay.
Or Brewer Hicklin, who's not on the 40 man. So that's Brewer not Hicklin an obvious would be
interesting. Move. Yeah. But the 40 man, you know, crunch is already a real thing with Gasser, who's right. about to come up. Although, you know, I think there's probably some guys you can DFA on there, but yeah, I don't know if Brewer Hicklin like moves the needle significantly on like the roster talent either.
Like,
the guys they have are either here and starting or they're on the injured list. That's where they are.
Yeah. I mean, I think Dunn is the natural fit if Christian Yelich were to come back, for example, because you still have Monasterio as your like option at third base. If Joey Ortiz can't work out, you don't get a lefty unless Tyler Black is playing third base, but we know that's a little bit of an adventure and probably not going to happen. He has not played third base in the minors more than one game this year, so I don't think that's on the table for them. So I guess they lose a little bit of flexibility, but like at some like month into the season, you got to get your best guys out there, right? Like you've got to you're right though. It is a case of if he's gone, who takes that spot? So I think, getting a couple guys healthy sure would help. Christian Yelich, getting him healthy would help. That's who we're talking about when we're talking about getting guys healthy. Okay, Kurt, let's move into the next phase of this. Let's go into some of the granular details from the week that was. It is this weekly segment, three up, three down. Kurt, I'm going to go first. I'm going to go to Tuesday because Tuesday, we could just spend the entire thing on Tuesday's game. Tuesday's game was a wild time. And Tyler Black's debut was definitely part of that. Now, Gary Sanchez, like you mentioned, pulling up Liam a little bit with a hamstring and wild situation that he's not on the injured list. I'm just blown away that they didn't have a roster move right away on Wednesday because Sanchez looked pretty worse for wear, but he's still on the roster. He actually had to go into the game at one point, not by choice when the Brewers were low on position players later in the week. But Tyler Black's father, Rod Black, former announcer for the Toronto Blue Jays, was on the microphone with Sophia Minert on the TV broadcast when Black came up for the second time. Tyler Black took Gary Sanchez's place, doubled in his first at-bat, first major league hit. And then for a second major league hit, Rod Black is on the call. Great moment. Just an awesome, awesome moment. This is before all the brawl stuff. And he, laces a single into center field. Rod Black with a great call, you know, base hit to center for my son, my boy, I think he said, Tyler Black. So really great, wholesome moment. It's cool that Tyler Black is here. I don't know if he's going to be here continuously. Like I could see them having to option him back down because defensively it's still a work in progress. We saw that a little bit at first base, even on Wednesday when he was tasked to play there. It's up and down, but the bat should play once he, you know, gets through the first wave of being a rookie. And he's shown it a little bit already.
Is this the part of the segment where we talk about the offense being bad?
Have we not talked about that already? I feel like that's kind of a recurring
a little
theme.
Bit, but like
that's like the last 4 years of this podcast, Kurt.
That's what I'm. Yeah, this feels like I'm getting into 2023 again. But JR, they did not score a single run against the Cubs starters. And all due respect to Javier Assad, who's actually been really good.
He's been great. Like
May of last year, Jameson Taillon and Hayden Wesneski, who's been between
AAA also been good,
and between levels this year. Mm-hmm. The Brewers did not score a single run against the starting pitching of the Cubs, and that's slightly concerning because the offense is still pretty reliant on like them getting some singles and a couple guys hitting them in. And like if Willie Thomas and Rhys Hoskins aren't going, this equation gets a lot murkier. It doesn't need to be a whole thing on the offense and saying the whole offense is bad, but it was pretty bad this weekend.
Bad.
Except for against a couple Cubs relievers who were also pretty bad.
Yes, the Cubs bullpen needs some work, but as you said, this team isn't just, you know, like they are not built to just do what they've done the last few years, and that's be passable at most charitable on offense. They were supposed to hit their way through the fact that they don't have any starting pitchers. They're not doing that right now. We knew that the whole singles parade thing was unsustainable. I mean, that's just common sense. And, you know, you've got a guy like Jackson Chourio who's working through it. He's, you know, down a little bit and he's going to have to fight his way back up. He had a nice moment on Friday when he kind of catalyzed a rally there. But you've got guys, you know, guys like we mentioned, Oliver Dunn, who's struggling on offense. Willie Adames has been up and down a little bit, but he was definitely down this weekend. Jake Bowers has not been good offensively. That's not really his role per se. Blake Perkins has come back to earth a little bit since he started out hot. Bryce Durang's still been good, but they're not clubbing any home runs in this series with some rare exception, with Perkins actually as the exception. So yeah, it's not feeling good. It's not feeling good, Kurt. They got to be better than that. Let's see. What do we got next? You know, I'm going to go back to Tuesday. Let's do it. We said Joey Weimer has struggled. He has. He stole a home run. Like, he just straight up went into the corner and took a home run away. That's like the second, or at least the second, maybe the third home run theft that Brewers outfielders have had this year. Again, this would be one of the things we focused on from this game, except it turns out it's like the 10th most interesting thing in this game because of how it transpired. But a nice moment for Joey Weimer, whose defense has not been good this year after he really showed that he could play center field and in a very credible way last year. You know, he's had a couple weird gaffes out there, and then he comes up with this spectacular play. Unfortunately for him, he kind of chased after a ball and tweaked his knee in Chicago and had to leave the game, and he ends up now on the injured list and out for a couple weeks. So bit of a setback, of course, but he was already scuffling, and that was a spot, I think, you know, again, going back to Christian Yelich, when he's here, Joey Weimer's spot on the roster is tenuous at best. So that's kind of an interesting turn of events, but man, what a play, you know. It had no shelf life because of how the rest of that game went, but a great theft.
We should talk about the comeback on Friday. The Brewers did win a game in this Cubs series, even though they probably could have and should have been swept. Albert Alzolay has been rough this year, and the Brewers just bludgeoned him to death with singles in two strike counts because he just couldn't put them away, and stealing bases because he couldn't hold them on. Four singles and four steals in an inning leads to three runs and a Brewers win. It was kind of a fun rally in that way. Like, they all just kept keeping that bat alive and then finding a way to put one in the outfield. And yeah, Churio, like you said, catalyzed that rally. And it was Cubs fans, like, as soon as the bullpen got in the game, you could tell things were dicey.
Yes. Jackson Churio, William Contreras, Willie Adames, and Jake Bowers all stole bases. First time since 2016 that the Brewers have done that. Chris Carter stole a base that day in that inning. Four stolen bases in an inning, and Chris Carter was one of them. Surprise, surprise. First time, I believe, in franchise history that four different players have been responsible for four stolen bases in an inning. So, yeah, that's an interesting time. Cubs relievers, they didn't really hold anybody on, so they just kept giving up second base and then giving singles away, and the Brewers were able to rally for that win. Not bad. What am I closing with? Kurt, I may not have any good one. You know, I'll just go with Wednesday. We thought we were going to get through that game without any umpire shenanigans. It was going to be the first time in four games that there was no pool report. And then in the ninth inning, Kurt, in the ninth inning, the umpires pause the game. Thiago Vieira is checking in, and they have taken his glove. And we have no idea what's happening with that glove. They confiscate it. They take it off the field. They give him a bright yellow glove instead. I think we kind of saw what was happening there. Vieira's glove is two-toned. It's blue and gray. You're not supposed to have a gray or a white glove. That makes it hard to pick up the baseball unnaturally because you've got the color schemes kind of close to that. Vieira did pitch the night before and, in fact, celebrated like a madman when the Brewers won that game on Tuesday, that wild Tuesday night game. So he did use that glove the night before. I mean, Ricky Weeks even said this, like, probably in the whole melee of the night, they didn't think about clearing that glove out, but very simple. And it wasn't obviously a problem. It wasn't obviously a pool report. It was just funny how here we go again. Ninth inning, you thought you were going to make it through. Here's one more call before you go.
You silly, silly fools. You thought you were going to get no. I guess this wasn't a controversial call, but there was like some frustration with the Brewers over the selective enforcement of it.
Mm-hmm. Devin didn't love it.
Yeah.
Devin Williams didn't love it.
Devin has not pitched this year, but he has voiced his displeasure with Guccione's decisions.
Yes.
I'll wrap it up with something else from that Wednesday game. Willie Adames, two homer game. His offensive numbers this year, actually really good, even though it doesn't feel like it, maybe. I don't know what to make of that. I was surprised to see like how valuable he's been, according to the numbers this season, because it just doesn't quite feel like it's matched it. But, you know, he's had a good start to the year.
Yeah, 800 OPS, still six homers. tied for the team lead with Rhys Hoskins, 22 RBIs, is second on the team behind William Contreras. He's also got 5 stolen bases. He's done really well. You're right. And his defense has been solid, as you would expect. So it's been okay. I do feel like sometimes there's some streaks to that game, but I suppose that's true of a lot of guys. So it's hard to hold that against them. All right, that's it for 3 Up, 3 Down. Let's go back in time. Let's do our weekly segment on Brewers history. It is Remember When. Kurt, I'm so glad I did something on the 1979 brawl last week with the Yankees and the Brewers, because then we got, you know, a brawl early on in the week. So it was very prescient. And what it did was it allowed me to go back to several brawls and chronicle them for JSOnline.com. Just a history of notable brawls, including Albert Bell versus Fernando Vina, Phil Garner versus Terry Bevington, that the 1979 one, the one where Nigel Morgan was riling up the St. Louis Cardinals. And then there's this one, which is interesting because I learned something I did not know. It's a 1990 brawl with the Seattle Mariners, June 30th, 1990. And the part that I learned that was new was a 79-year-old woman named Agatha Doman, who is a Blue Jays fan. She was sitting in the front row that night, or near the front row, and apparently she has quite the following in Toronto, as a woman who was fed up with the players brawling with each other, as they did on this particular day, the Mariners and the Brewers. And she, I've been saying Toronto, I think, but this is actually against the Mariners. This is in Seattle, not Toronto. So ignore everything I said about Toronto. Let's come back to the States, just a little bit south. And, you know, well west. And this woman, Agatha Doman, started hitting a Brewers player with her handbag because she was so frustrated with how things were going. The players had spilled down the right field line. She was down the first baseline and wallops a Brewer. It's not on video, sadly, but she kind of became a little bit of a legend in Seattle. She passed away a few years ago, and her whole obituary is about how she went to this game and was upset that the players were brawling in 1990 and walloped the Brewers player with her handbag. Very funny. I wish it were on video. So bad. So bad. What caused the whole thing? It seems kind of dumb. Bob Sebra, who's a pitcher that never threw another pitch in the big leagues. I had never heard of him. He hits a guy named Tony Jones in the ribs. And actually, he didn't hit him that hard, actually. But Jones started jawing with BJ Surhoff, the catcher. They started exchanging words. 20 minutes of brawl go by. This has got to be the longest brawl in Brewers history. There's some great quotes. Jim LaFever, who eventually became the Brewers interim manager, but at the time he was Mariners manager, referring to Bob Sebra, the Brewers pitcher that I never heard of. He's like, how stupid can you get? I detest someone who has to hit somebody just because he can't get anybody out. He shouldn't be in the league. It shouldn't be in the league. What's his ERA anyway? And the answer, it was 8.18. It was a really high ERA. Jim LaFever had a point. Bob Sebra, again, did not pitch again in the big leagues. Tom Treblehorn got like thrown down a couple times and wound up like with this tattered jersey. Treblehorn supposedly kept egging people on, saying it's not over. He insisted he was saying it was over and needed it to be done, but it would stop and start. It was this whole thing. You can see the video on YouTube. It's all there. Again, 1990 brawl in the kingdom between the Brewers and the Mariners, June 30th, 1990. Wild stuff. So yes, looking back at some memorable brawls, there's some fun ones. Fun in quotes, you know. We don't want to condone violence, but do we kind of condone it when it's funny? We kind of do. I'm not going to lie to you. We kind of do. So you can check that out at jsonline.com. All right, that's it for Remember When. We're done with Back in Time. Let's look ahead just a bit with Kurt's take of the week. Here it is, Kurt Blanche.
I would like to talk about brawls a little more. And by a little more, I mean just a little more. I don't know.
Are we wrong? Are we condoning too much?
I think having seen one up close and covered a team that got engaged in a brawl over literally nothing.
Yeah.
I have some things to retract. Fewer brawls. We do not need these.
Oh, really?
We do not need these. Baseball players are really bad at fighting. Those punches were terrible.
Like, were they punches? They were slaps.
The only person that got hit was Sal Frelick by a stray for trying to break it up. And it wasn't even like, we just, you know what? I like fighting in sports, I think, from an entertainment standpoint. But we're not good at this in baseball. We're not good at this. And it, like, unless it stems from something fun, or not even fun, but maybe like something legit, where you accuse someone of something else, and the other fellow says, you know, he the first guy calls your something into question, and you tell that other fellow, would you like to engage in fisticuffs? And then they do, and those two do get out, like, whatever. But this is just too much. I've seen enough. I take it all back. No more fights.
I think we underestimate just, I mean, football and basketball, the other two sports that, well, and hockey for sure, all of them. In those games, players are contacting each other throughout the game. There is, you just develop an understanding that you're going to be running into other players. And I think that's why maybe they're a little better at fighting. They're used to kind of like body on body contact. Like there's going to be sort of fisticuffs of that nature from time to time. Baseball players don't even like remotely touch each other unless it's a tag play, you know, like they're just living, they're parallel playing. They are the toddlers of the pro sports realm where they are parallel playing. And so, you know, when they do come together, it just feels unnatural. It feels awkward. Like these guys don't throw punches. These guys throw a tiny sphere around the diamond. This is not their nature. So
it does feel
performative.
That gets, I think that's at the crux of my whole thought here is these guys can't fight. I can't fight. I know what being unable to fight looks like.
If I had to throw a punch, it would look awkward. I'm confident.
That much is probably true.
Yes.
And like, unless you're doing something cool, like picking a guy up and trying to body slam him, I just don't need it. Just save it for hockey. Let the hockey guys go at it.
They're good at it.
Like football fights are stupid too. Football fights are even worse because they like punch each other in the helmet.
That's so stupid.
You idiot.
It's so good.
He's got a face mask on.
Yeah.
He's wearing head protection and it hurts you. So let's leave it to NHL and then like occasionally in the NBA. Unless you want to make it worth my while and suplex a guy.
I don't know. I'm trapped between not wanting to condone this, acknowledging it's bad, and also being entertained. I don't know, Kurt. How do I stand on that? I was a little entertained. It's bad, but was I entertained? I was.
No, I was not.
I was entertained.
I was not entertained by this. The whole premise was stupid, and then the fight was bad.
I know, but I was having a good time. I was having a good time. I don't know what to do with that feeling. It's very strange. Okay, that's enough. The Milwaukee Brewers, 3-3 this week. They are 20-13. They're going to need to win 10 in a row, Kurt, so that I can say that both first-year managers in Milwaukee pro sports were 30-13 at one point this season. I am deeply despairing that is looking less and less likely, but they are going to start
the week. Do you think Pat Murphy would get fired after starting 30-13?
I do not think that Pat Murphy would get fired after starting 30-13. I think that people would write feature stories about him more than they already have. There is a chance, Kurt, that they win their next 10 games because, well, they're going to Kansas City to face the Royals. Royals are actually playing really quite well. So, but, you know, traditionally, the Royals have not been a huge obstacle.
No, there is no chance that this team wins 10 games in a row.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. No. Except it's baseball, so there is. But then 4 games against the Cardinals at home. The Cardinals, of course, have struggled this year. 3 against the Pirates also at home. It's a 7-game homestand coming up into next week before they head out on a 3-city road trip to Houston, Miami, and Boston. So conference division rivalries coming up here. Of course, the Cubs later this month that we discussed on Memorial Day. That will do it for this edition of Microbrew. He is Kurt Hoag. Thank you, Kurt. We'll talk to you again very soon.
Yeah, I'm delirious. I'm going to bed.
I understand.
It's been a long weekend.
It's been a long weekend. There he is, Kurt Hoag, Brewers reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Find us on Stitcher, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Here now, we've got some interviews. I talked to Tobias Myers. That's the one you're going to hear first. Brewers pitcher, of course, was kind of fascinated to hear about the start to his big league career. After that, it's Ben Rortvedt, Verona catcher. He's had some really interesting injury stuff. He is now with the Tampa Bay Rays, started all 3 games early this past week at American Family Field. So talked about his career, his injuries, getting to this point. So all stuff that I thought was kind of interesting. Hope you enjoy those interviews. We'll talk to you again very soon. Bye-bye. My guest is Tobias Myers, starting pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers. New arrival, made his major league debut last week with against the Pittsburgh Pirates. First pitch, Andrew McCutchen. I think you grew up near him, right? I don't know how close he grew up, you know, when he was first starting baseball
how much you know about him, but like, was the were you aware of him at a very young age, Andrew McCutchen?
Yeah, so he grew up about 45 minutes from me in Fort Meade, Florida. I grew up in Winter Haven, Florida.
Okay.
Both in Polk County.
Okay.
So I knew about Andrew, obviously, when he was in the big leagues. I didn't know too much about him before the big leagues. I think I was maybe a little too young, but I just remember I went to one of his camps when I was younger as a kid. The coach who threw BP to him in the Home Run Derby, Coach Bradlin.
Yeah.
He actually coached me a little bit growing up.
Oh, that's cool.
I would spend some time over in Fort Meade, and I would, seventh grade, I played JV summer ball with Fort Meade High School.
Really?
Just to play, just to get a little experience with a couple older guys. And that was where, like, the Andrew McCutchen, where I started paying attention a lot, and I knew who he was, and we went to the camp. And
that's cool.
We actually worked out together after a 2021 season.
Okay.
Didn't talk too much. He's in the off season where everybody's doing their own thing, trying to get in and out. But yeah, I've known about Andrew for years.
Cool. Did he know you though, going into that at bat?
I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so.
So this is a question you got asked a lot, but first pitch goes poorly, you would expect that to rattle some people. Obviously it didn't seem to rattle you. You had a fantastic outing after that. Where does that come from? Where does the calm come from? I mean, that's your first big league game. I mean, and you handle it so smoothly. Where'd that all come from?
I think just the failure over the last, in the 2022 season especially, taught me a lot about myself. Taught me, I think, how to deal with failure.
Sure.
That was like the first year of my life that I've failed, and I failed for the whole year from start to the end. DFA 3 times, released at the end of the year, and it just taught me that, like, everything isn't as important as I think it is in my head, as far as the day-to-day, just being able to realize it's okay to fail. It's okay to give up a homer to a big leaguer. It's okay to walk a guy. It's okay to, as long as you just don't let it trickle down and affect you, which I think I'm doing a pretty good job of that, just pitch by pitch, going one pitch at a time.
Yeah. For the minor league career you've had is kind of high profile as minor league careers go. And that has to do with the big trades that you've been a part of.
Right.
I'm sure you get asked about Junior Caminero all the time, but it's also Tim Beckham, you know, the number one pick in the draft at one point. That's the first time you're traded. What is your relationship to those guys? You hear those names a lot. I'm sure you're getting sick of being asked about them. I guess even a bigger question is, how would you describe your minor league career? You said it's been up and down, but it's been a lot of success too.
Yeah.
How would you describe it?
I think when I was just younger, when I first got drafted, I was 17, and I just didn't have the mindset of I wanted to move up quick and I wanted to get to the big leagues right now. I thought I was just so young, and I thought it was like a year-to-year type of thing. Like, you go to low A 1 year, you go to high A 1 year.
For sure.
I just had no thought of I want to get moved up to double A, triple A, and go to the big leagues this year. I was just trying to take it 1 year at a time.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of hindered me a little bit because there was no rush in my head.
Sure.
So after being put on the roster in 2022 with Cleveland, that's when I think all in one moment I tried to rush everything.
Sure.
And like I wanted to be in the big leagues right there. I thought I should have been in the big leagues all year, which obviously I shouldn't have because the way I threw. But I just think I put all that pressure of just the relaxation of all those years, I put it all into that 1 year. And I think it just screwed in my head a little bit and wasn't able to focus on what I needed to focus on, which was pitching. And I was focused on everything else other than pitching. But I think it just took me going through that to learn that it's not about that. It's not about me. It's about when you get up here, it's about helping the team win. And that's all it's about. It doesn't matter if you go 5 innings, give up 8 runs. If you win 9-8, you did your job.
Like, sure.
That's all that matters up here. And I love the competitive side of the game. Like, for me in the minor leagues, I feel like it's not as win first, so it's more so a development, and I'm a very big competitor, so I love that there's one mindset up here, and it's win.
When you've had, as elite a caliber prospect as you are, all these different organizations, a lot of different pitching coaches, a lot of different philosophies, is that difficult? Like, did you find that you're taking a little bit from each stop, or that you're kind of just staying true to one or two voices in your head that you know, to keep moving forward, I imagine, is difficult when you got people, maybe we could tweak this and tweak that. I don't know how you did that.
Right. Yeah. It's happened. It's definitely happened throughout the years. 2022 was a big example where I tried to become a pitcher that I wasn't. I tried to become a guy who threw like backdoor cutters and front hip chain and just I'm a guy who's going to go right at you with the heater and let everything play off that. And I think it took me a while to learn who I am. And I think after that season, and then coming here in 2023 last year,
yeah,
they just told me, hey, be you, whatever you feel natural, be you, do that, and let's see what happens. And I found out how to pitch, I think, last year, and still learn every day. Like, I was just talking to Hookie, and I was like, I feel like I'm just learning how to pitch right now. Like,
yeah,
learning how to truly pitch. And I think that's just something that it just took time.
So even from 23 to 24, there's a jump up. Is that all it is? Is it just a natural learning how to pitch, or do you feel like you came into this year with something new, something special?
Confidence, definitely. Confidence sure. is definitely up after the season last year. Just learning that, like, my stuff plays in every level. Like, I've been to big league camp for 3 years, and every time I go to big league camp and I face the big league guys and I'm around them, I kind of feel like, I can do this. I fit here. I feel like I can do what these guys do. And I think it was just truly believing in myself.
Yeah.
And I think I believe it now for sure, but it just took a little time.
Sure. You're one of the first guys out at big league camp this year. I don't know if you could have envisioned being in the big league roster in April. Maybe you still could, but give me the sense of, like, when that call came and if you're aware of the pitching situation in Milwaukee. I'm sure a little bit with the injuries and stuff, like,
yeah,
how that all played out for you.
Yeah. I think I knew it was going to come sooner rather than later, but sure. I didn't expect it to come this early in the season. I think I said it before in the first interview I got here, was I just wanted to make sure when I did get here, I was prepared.
Yeah.
And that's all I was focusing on all offseason, all spring training, was just making sure I'm prepared to pitch in the big leagues mentally and physically.
All right. Anything else that people should know about you? Anything else that you're into? People only know you about two starts at this point. There's got to be more, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, I started golfing a lot this offseason.
Awesome.
But I think that, honestly, that helped me just get the game off my mind. Like, I'd go in the morning, work out, do all my baseball work, obviously, early in the morning. And then being able to just go, like, golf with the boys and just have fun and get my mind off of baseball, I think that's helped me a lot.
Perfect.
And I've continued to do it throughout the season. I don't think I'll be able to golf much up here.
No, maybe not. But golf is growing in Wisconsin. So if you find yourself with some time, maybe during the All-Star break.
Maybe. You never know. But I think that's helped me a lot. And watching a lot of golf, like, learning that sport's hard, man.
Yeah.
All sports are hard. It's okay to fail. Like, that was a big one, watching these guys go out there, some of the best golfers in the world, and have terrible tournaments and terrible rounds. And
for sure.
It's just helped me learn that a lot of it's mental, and just trying to build the mental strength to kind of be able to brush things away and just go next pitch. It's the next pitch.
Absolutely.
Next pitch.
All right, Tobias, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
My guest is Ben Rortvedt. He is the catcher for the Tampa Bay Rays, a Verona High School native. First Verona High School native to make Major League Baseball. Does that sound right to you?
I'm not sure.
You probably are, I think. I think it's your mom's birthday today or sometime this week. So
today.
Who's here for you? How big of a group do you have in Milwaukee this weekend? I think it is your first time playing at Miller Park or at American Family Field, right?
Yep, this is the first time here. I missed the trip the past two times that it's been scheduled. Mom's here with her whole side, dad's whole side, a lot of aunts and uncles, a lot of friends, a lot of people that I didn't know were coming that I've seen in the stands. That's been pretty cool. But yeah, just a whole group of all my family's been supportive on both ends.
For people who don't know, because they follow the Brewers, can you briefly go through the injuries that you faced, particularly this aneurysm that popped up last year? Like, how would you describe it? And I guess in general, just how injuries have impacted your career to this point.
Yeah. So injury-wise, 2019, I had knee surgery 2016 going into the draft. That was probably the first one. 2019, my second knee surgery. And then 2021, I debuted with the Twins.
Right.
Next year was a lockout, and after the lockout, I got traded. Went to the Yankees with an oblique strain.
Rehabbed
that.
Yeah.
Was about to come back on rehab games. Had my third knee surgery, so that put me out to about the halfway point. And then
cropped up while you were rehabbing the knee, right?
Yep, and then I finished that year, the second half, out playing. Didn't play too well, but learned a lot that year, kind of like managing a lot of stuff. And then last year, going into spring training, had a really weird my finger was blue and cold, and I took going to a lot of like doctors and specialists to figure out that I had an aneurysm in my shoulder. So I had to get that fixed, and then ended up completing that year, and then that kind of, and now I'm here. So
yeah, and the trade before this season to bring you here. This is not, like you said, this is not the first time you've been traded. It's kind of a weird moment. So I don't know if that was, if that caught you off guard, or if that forced you to scramble. Like, how would you describe those crazy few days before the season began?
It was a little bit of scramble, but there's a lot of things that you couldn't control. So sure. I knew kind of some things were happening behind the scenes, so I was prepared for anything. Obviously, the Yankees is an incredible organization, but they kind of had a roster pinch, so I understood kind of the situation I was in. I'm very grateful to end up in a place like Tampa to have a shot at a lot of playing time and help a ball club win.
What is just health, you think, this year? I mean, you're off to such a good start. Is it just that, or opportunity? Opportunity meets health, I guess.
Opportunity meets health. Fail. You learn a lot when you fail. Learn a lot about myself the past 3 years. Kind of what kind of player I want to be, what kind of player I am, and just what to do day in and day out to try to have success in the field and help the team win.
Yeah, and you got to pitch. Have you done? When's the last time you did that?
I haven't pitched since Little League.
Really?
Yeah,
oh man, how did you end up volunteering for that then?
Cash just asked if I could throw strikes, and I gladly volunteered.
And then if you just stopped after one inning, it would have been flawless. Yeah, they would sent you back out. I don't know if that was expected, that you'd have a second inning on top of that. That's that's too bad. Cool. It was great. I want to go back to, because you're here in Milwaukee, and there was this play a couple nights ago as we record this where a backswing ended up impacting how things went in the ninth. For a lot of people, like even us who cover it, we don't know the rule book in and out. As a catcher, do you know all the ins and outs of the rule book? I would imagine so, but I don't know if you ever get caught off guard when something like this pops up in a baseball game.
There's a lot of little intricacies with the position as well, kind of things you can't do, things that inherit kind of like all play. That's one I haven't seen before. I've seen backswings a lot, and that is a dead ball.
Yeah.
The occasion that happened was a pretty, it was game changing. So that's the first time I've seen it. I thought he made the correct call, but obviously there's a lot of things that go into play at that point, and that's a very tough situation and call to make in that moment. And that's just a really tough play, and it depends on who you ask, but I think he got that one right. Because it is a tough call to make, but he did impact the play. Yeah. So
you're drafted at the same time as Gavin Lux. I think Alex Call is in that draft. Do you know those guys? And did you feel like at the time Wisconsin baseball, which has kind of risen over the past few years, was kind of having a moment at that point?
Yeah, know Gavin really well. Alex Call, I know now, but sure. I did not know back
out west,
in the day.
I guess.
Yeah, grew up with Gavin, played a lot of travel ball with him, stayed with him a lot, so a very talented player. We didn't think anything else of it. I mean, that's all we knew was being up here and playing. And I guess it was at a time that we got a lot of recognition. And I don't want to say we put people on the map, because there was a lot of people that came before us that did a great job of representing Wisconsin. But it is a time that we played well in front of people that gave us a lot of opportunities and chances. Yeah. So we're very grateful to get the opportunities that we have. We're very grateful to be able to represent Wisconsin that way.
Were you somebody who focused on pitch framing, even because I know that's something that's credited as a strength of yours? Was that also in high school at the point? Had that already gotten into the consciousness when you were coming up through Verona?
Everyone kind of focused on receiving, but there was no, I guess, way to really gauge it at that point in time. There was no really way to like measure how good someone is based on kind of like the eye test. So not really. There a lot of things were weighed in with blocking and throwing, and there was just no really way to really measure how good a catcher was receiving until the past couple of years. So something everyone always worked on, but there wasn't an exact like form or art to it back then. So
all right, last one. Do you feel settled in as a big leaguer? I know you had a lot of moving around, a lot of disappointment, but now does it feel like you've kind of arrived, or are you taking it one day at a time? How do you look at this right now?
I don't want to feel like I've ever arrived or I'm settled in, because at that point you're complacent. I think there's a lot of growth in my game, and that everyone can have, and as soon as you're complacent, it's somewhere that you feel like you don't have to do much, but I feel like that I have to strike a better game.
All right, sir. Thank you so much.